come you masters of war. You that build the big guns, you that build the death planes, you that build all the bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind discs. I
just don't want you. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Khalid El-Gindi, who is a fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009 and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. Welcome to Background Briefing, Khalid El-Gindi.
Thanks for having me.
And already the Egyptian government of President Mohamed Morsi have condemned the Israeli airstrikes on the Gaza, demanding a ceasefire and basically accusing Israel of seeking to drag the region towards instability. What's your take on what happened? You have to assume that Netanyahu knew when he ordered this strike that there would be a tit for tat. Isn't the retaliation inevitable?
Sure, and it's been very predictable that we've had these tit for tat periodic escalations in the past. Over the past few years, we've seen the cycle of escalation and ceasefire, escalation and ceasefire, and sometimes the escalation is bigger than other times, and there are concerns that it'll get even bigger. And I think this is one of those cases where things did escalate to a point where the Egyptians have always been involved in terms of trying to broker ceasefires, and because they have a border with Gaza. But it is a predictable outcome. I think the more you escalate, the more we're likely to see a response. And you can see that in one of the stated Israeli goals of this operation, and this are, according to the Israeli military, is to restore their deterrent capability. The deterrent from rocket fire into Israel from Gaza. And that is what they're trying to deter. But deterrence is there are many different ways to go about deterrence. And military means alone is unlikely to achieve that deterrent goal that the Israelis seek.
Well, in a way, though, we've seen this movie before, I'm sad to say. After the assassination of, leading up to the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin and afterwards, when Netanyahu came to power, there were a lot of targeted assassinations against Palestinians that led to the very responses that were predictable, and that, in fact, enabled Netanyahu to come to power, in effect. Rabin's widow, Leah, always accused Netanyahu of being responsible, in part, for the death of her husband. So he's got an election coming up in January. Is he trying to become a wartime president? He's in trouble at home because he's so overtly supported Mitt Romney, and I think a lot of Israelis are concerned that Netanyahu may have alienated the White House, and they want good relations with the United States. So is there a domestic component to this, do you think, in terms of Israeli politics?
Oh, I think there's always a domestic component for any country that is operating. There's always a consideration of how it impacts domestic policy, and I think that's certainly true in Israel as well. So, I think the logic on the Israeli side is we cannot have Israeli communities that are being bombarded by rockets go unanswered because we, the Israeli government, will be held accountable come election time. Israeli citizens expect to be safe in their homes, in their schools, in their communities, and we have a responsibility to do that. That's the most obvious direct line in terms of domestic Israeli politics. There may be, you know, there may be more to it than that. I don't know. I think it's also true that there's an American political domestic component as well. You know, the leader of Israel doesn't undertake an action like this without calculating what the response is going to be from their neighbors in the region, from the United States, and within the United States, what the response is going to be from Congress, from the White House, from the security establishment, from the president's national security team. All of these had to have gone into the calculation, into the thinking of undertaking this kind of an operation. So I think American politics is also on Netanyahu's mind. I'm not saying it's the sole motivation or the most important motivation, but it would be, I think, unusual if it didn't factor in.
So if that's the case, then first of all, Israel has a very delicate relationship with this new Egyptian government, and this is clearly not helping. They have a treaty which they want to preserve, and it's unpopular in Egypt. So a similar situation exists, I believe, in Jordan, where there's a treaty, but it's also unpopular, and there's a lot of pressure on the Jordanian king from his own restive population. And then you've got the Palestinian Authority, who are looking kind of impotent in this situation. So I don't understand what the logic behind a provocation is, unless you're saying it's just entirely to do with stopping rocket attacks.
Well, I think you have to look beyond the immediate actors on the ground. You have to look at the broader regional situation and rivalries and power configuration that exists in the region. And you have a government in Israel that is determined to scale back what they perceive as an Iranian threat, a nuclear capability threat, or at least the potential of a nuclear Iran, and that they see that as their number one threat in the region. And you have inside Gaza, Hamas, which is, they are casting, they're talking about in terms of an Iranian-backed terrorist organization, quote-unquote. And I think we partially have to see this in those regional terms as well. This is a message, you know, Iran has very few friends left in the Arab world. And now you have this alignment of forces in the region and in the international community against Iran. And Hamas is one of the few friends, in a sense, that Iran still has. And so this is partly, I think, a proxy war between Israel and Iran. It's partly, I think, a message to Egypt and a way to test the new Egyptian government and their resolve. Test the durability of the peace treaty. Will a Muslim Brotherhood-backed government maintain the treaty? Will they respond any differently to this than the Mubarak regime did? You know, the Morsi government withdrew the Egyptian ambassador from Tel Aviv. It's a similar type of action that Mubarak did in the past in similar circumstances. So I think there are lots of different angles to this, in addition to the direct stakeholders on the ground. And then, of course, you have in the context of this split between Hamas and Fatah in the West Bank and Gaza, would this be likely if you had a unified Palestinian polity in which there was one president over both the West Bank and Gaza, would Israel have as free of a hand to act in Gaza as it is now, I think is another question. I think One thing that has to come out of this is people need to start thinking on how to resolve these multiple crises at the same time, because they have similar solutions. You know, you cannot resolve the situation between Gaza and Israel without also tackling the situation between the rift between Hamas and Fatah on the Palestinian side, and also without tackling the security issues that Egypt has on its borders between the Gaza Strip and the Sinai Peninsula. And also Israel has an interest in clamping down on the arms, weapons smuggling into Gaza. So there is in this kind of multi-layered crisis situation, there is actually an opportunity to try and resolve all of these different conflicts in a much more durable way, instead of treating them as separate and independent crises. They all are interconnected. And I'll give you an example. After the last Gaza war, it was, if you look at Palestinian opinion polls in 2009, it was Abu Mazen, the Palestinian president in the West Bank, Mahmoud Abbas, who suffered the biggest loss in his popularity. He took the biggest hit politically precisely because of that perceived impotence. And I think we're likely to see Abbas be another unintended consequence or victim of this operation as well. If the target may be Hamas on the ground, but the victim may actually be the leadership in the West Bank because of their inability to do anything.
Again, I'm speaking with Khalid El-Gindi, who's a fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009 and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. So my understanding is that there are secret negotiations going on between the Obama White House and the Iranians, perhaps involving Valerie Jarrett. Is that possible that this has provoked Netanyahu? In other words, he's always wanted to basically say that Iran is the real problem. And the more we talk about Iran and talk about bombing Iran, etc., the more the Palestinians become irrelevant. And frankly, the Palestinian issue has been on pretty much invisible now for the last couple of years. So is that what's going on here? He's, he's sort of sided with Romney. He's lost out. And maybe Obama doesn't owe him anything and is going his own way with the Iranians. And this is one way of changing the subject.
I mean, I definitely think there is an Iran dimension to this escalation and this situation on the ground in Gaza. I can't speak to the specifics. I don't have that kind of inside information about whether these secret talks are happening or whether this is part of that process or a motivation in that. But I think it's plausible that Israeli concerns about Iran are at least partly motivating this response and this escalation. I mean, this didn't have to escalate to this point. In the past, there have been these, flare-ups. There was a ceasefire called, and we looked actually for a moment like we were, the Egyptians were frantically trying to broker a ceasefire, and there was talk of, all the factions had agreed. It looked like a ceasefire might be imminent, and then we saw the assassination of a Hamas military commander and other targets, Hamas targets. And so there was this dramatic escalation on the part of Israel. So I think it's at least partly related to Iran. I think you can't take Iranian concerns out of the equation. I think it's clearly part of Israeli thinking. But there's a broader regional dynamic at play. There is a very fragile relationship with Egypt. And then I'm sure that's also part of what is being tested. there is a situation between Palestinians. How will this affect the chances for Palestinian unity? If anything, it might push the two back together. At the end of the day, this is a political problem, and it will have to have a political solution. It can't purely be a military one. And there are political realities on the ground that need to be accommodated and taken into account on all sides, on the Israeli side, on the Palestinian side, on the Egyptian side. And so all of those have to be factored in. Otherwise, we're going to see just more instability and continued flare-ups. And that's not good for anyone. We need a longer-term, holistic and integrated approaches and solutions, and not simply one-dimensional, one-sided fixes that create more instability.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Khaled El-Gindi.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Khaled El-Gindi, who's a fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009, and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about the implications of a government that can snoop on America's top spy. What does that say about the privacy of the rest of us?
This your war, cause until that day, the dream of lasting peace, war is legit.